Fighting the flu. Every year at this time, we are told to get our flu shots. Last year, fewer people did get their flu vaccinations, and there were a staggering number of cases of influenza nationwide, including 80,000 deaths. Here in Maine, the number of reported cases topped 9,000, and 82 people died from the flu. I'm Cindy Hahn. Join me for a conversation with two of our state's leading epidemiologists to learn more about dealing with the flu. We'll hear about how it affects your body, what to do to prevent it, or to at least minimize your symptoms. We'll also learn about the different strains of the virus and what to expect for the upcoming flu season, which has started already. Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Cindy Hahn, and this is Maine Calling. You see the signs everywhere at groceries and drugstores, get your free flu shot here. But less than half of adults in the U.S. got vaccinated for the flu last year, in what turned out to be the deadliest flu season in four decades. What do we need to know about the flu as this year's flu season begins? Joining me in the studio, Dr. Siri Bennett. She's the state epidemiologist for Maine. And Dr. August Valenti, he's the hospital epidemiologist for Maine Medical Center. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you have any concerns about getting a flu shot? Do you know anyone who had a severe case of the flu? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Now, you're both epidemiologists, as I just mentioned, and we asked you here to talk about the flu. But since you're here, I do have to ask you about the latest news on hepatitis A. There's been a case of a man in Portland with hepatitis A, and he had stayed in two of Portland's homeless shelters. So, Dr. Bennett, what is the concern here, and what is Maine doing about that?
Hepatitis A is of concern because it can be a short-lived but serious illness. The problem with hepatitis A and controlling it is that it has a long incubation period, meaning that you may have it for a month before you actually develop symptoms. But in the meantime, you may also actually start spreading the virus to others. And we're particularly concerned in this situation because the a case of hepatitis A that was reported to us is in a person experiencing homelessness. And there have been other very large outbreaks in other states over the last 2 years, actually, in that population and in persons who use drugs of any type. And these outbreaks are very difficult to control in that population. It partly because of the sometimes the lack of sanitation. It's spread very easily. And we've seen some really large outbreaks. And while we only have one case so far, we want to sort of nip it in the bud. And if we can, through a vaccination clinic, providing free vaccine to people who are experiencing homelessness, or people who are using IV injection drugs or non-injection drugs, we're happy to do that so we can try and keep people as healthy as possible.
And that is up and running, the free vaccines at the particular shelters?
The Preble Street Clinic will be holding the vaccine clinic tomorrow morning between, I think it's 8 a.m. and 1 p.m. And then on Thursday afternoon, I think it's 12 noon to 4. I'd have to check the hours. But it's Thursday afternoon and Wednesday morning.
Okay. And that's at the place where he actually contracted
We don't know where the case contracted the hepatitis A.
Okay.
But we know that the case visited the resource center and mm-hmm. stayed at several homeless shelters in the period during which the person was infectious.
Okay.
So we're being very, very cautious, but we do want to get the message out there that if you have been within the last month, between the 1st and the 21st of October, if you visited the resource center, may have had contact there, stayed in one of the shelters, please come and get vaccinated. You'll be healthier for it. Okay. And we can help limit the spread.
Okay, good to know. And while we're talking about other infectious diseases in the news, what about the cases of whooping cough on the rise in Maine that we've heard about, Dr. Valenti?
Yes, well, we are seeing whooping cough in the community. We generally see it every year. And so the big take home here is to make sure that you're vaccinated. There is an excellent, safe, and effective vaccine called the Tdap vaccine, which is an acellular vaccine, has far fewer reactions than the older vaccines. And so parents, grandparents, anyone taking care of youngsters need to get vaccinated. We're primarily concerned about young children who can have serious complications from the whooping cough. So getting vaccinated is the best way to manage this.
Okay, and they're keeping eye at the schools of outbreaks right now.
Yes.
Okay. Well, now we can focus on the flu. Has flu season begun yet? Do we have cases in Maine?
We have a few. It's early in the season, and technically surveillance started, I think, the beginning of October,
yes.
If I'm right.
And of the few, how bad are they? We don't have any deaths.
No, we have no deaths. We can't really say how bad they are. Flu is not a notifiable condition in and of itself.
What does that mean?
Meaning that it's not required to be reported to the state.
Oh.
And most people who have the flu don't actually go see their doctors. What is reportable are deaths, particularly among children from the flu, hospitalizations in particular, and very what we call novel influenza, which is influenza that may not be your typical influenza, but may be associated with either birds or swine.
Mm-hmm.
And those are generally, they're not your typical flu, and that's among travelers frequently.
Right, and that's not something we haven't heard much about those,
no.
Avian flu and swine flu.
No. Mm-mm.
Okay, but in terms of the deaths and the hospitalizations, last year was a really awful year for the flu. What is there a reason for that?
Yes, well, the H3N2 virus, which is a strain of influenza A, can cause particularly severe disease. In addition, the vaccine wasn't as effective as we like to see it. Vaccine effectiveness varies from year to year. But this year, or last season, it wasn't as effective as we'd like. I think the CDC reported it to be about 40% effective.
Right, right.
But there were other places which gave us much lower numbers. So it's also the way that we made vaccines previously with eggs. The H3N2 was difficult to make in egg cultures. So that made for a tough flu season.
And is there a way to predict how this coming flu season will be?
No.
No.
There's no crystal ball, unfortunately.
There's no crystal ball.
But why is that hard? Just because of the different strains?
Yes. We don't know whether or not – we never know until into the flu season whether or not vaccine matches are going to occur. The federal CDC and the ACIP, which is the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, gets together a panel of experts every year in February, and they try to match these strains. And sometimes I think generally they do a fantastic job, but they're not always right on. So we don't know how it's going to be. We don't know how many people are going to get vaccinated. It's hard to tell, so we can't really predict.
Yeah, and frequently the strain itself tends to sort of shift and change as the year goes on. So they may start out with something that looks like a pretty good match, but then the virus itself sort of shifts and changes.
Is it reacting to what
it's a constantly changing virus,
okay.
And it seems – and it's done this for years, and which is – why we always recommend that every year you get another flu vaccine, because it shifts.
Does that mean that there's any second vaccine that will come along during one season?
Well, the vaccine that we currently have actually covers for what they think is the most common three or four strains that are going to be out there. And so they've made a really good guess, educated guess, about what strains are going to be circulating. And so far, the evidence, just the preliminary reports, is that it's actually a pretty good match this year.
Yeah, it looks good. So far, what we've had back, the influenza A, which we worry the most about, although I know of one hospitalization with B, but that seems to be 100% match so far.
Yeah.
Dr. Bennett raises a really important point about the need for yearly vaccines. There's a technical term that when the virus, as it goes throughout the season, we call these little changes in the coating of the virus. There are proteins that coat the virus. We call that antigenic drift. When there's a significant change, for instance, if an animal influenza like avian or swine flu changes, we call that antigenic shift. And that is what keeps the director of the federal CDC up at night. I recently had an interview with CBS, and he was telling them that he's really worried, you know, that we're due for a pandemic. So it's that dramatic shift in the virus that we worry about.
When does it count as a pandemic? If it was really pretty bad last year, but we're not at the point where you would call it a pandemic?
Actually, it's a very technical epidemic, and pandemics are it's actually very technical. And there are actually stages to how we define what a pandemic is. But the H1N1, I think, is probably that you may remember that a few years ago. Mm-hmm. That was really a pandemic. But there are stages, and it's very technical.
Okay, I'm going to actually backtrack, because as you're talking about these different kinds of viruses, can you kind of just explain what happens in the body when this virus strikes and you get the flu? Where does it enter, and what then happens?
So what happens is that usually the influenza enters through the respiratory route, and usually we get colonized, or in the case of influenza, it's probably a fairly rapid situation. You get inflammation, which is what causes the sore throats and then the cough. And then it settles very nicely, thank you very much, in the lower respiratory tract, sometimes causing pneumonia. It can spread to other areas of the body. Influenza can be complicated by infections of the heart and the muscles and even the brain. That's sort of the pathophysiology of how influenza works. A lot of concern, though, comes when bacteria, which colonize the upper respiratory tract, get to descend into the lower respiratory tract, because influenza weakens the mechanical barriers, if you will, those barriers to infection that are in your upper respiratory tract, allowing it to descend. And then bacteria can superinfect a pneumonia and cause deaths. And that's what we see mostly among the elderly.
The complications from the actual flu.
That's correct.
Okay. When you talk about those symptoms, how does a person differentiate whether they have a cold or whether they have the flu if they've got those upper respiratory symptoms?
Well, you really can't. I mean, there are lots of viruses that mimic the flu. In fact, Dr. Bennett and I, you will usually use what we call influenza-like illness, or ILI, to designate anything that could be influenza. So the way you really tell is with a test. And we have excellent tests that are available now in many doctor's offices and in hospitals and clinics that can help us differentiate, at least tell us whether it's influenza or not. There are so many other viruses that sometimes it isn't worth trying to do all that testing.
It is confusing. Yeah. So when does someone know to go in and get a test? When should their sort of red flags go off?
There are differences between the cold and the flu in general. It's not true for everybody. If you've got a high fever, that's probably a better indication of flu rather than a cold. And the flu generally has a more abrupt onset. You're going to have more lethargy, feeling tired and weak. You're just going to feel real sick. Whereas a cold, it's more inconvenient than anything else.
Right. Yeah, we know that feeling.
And but a lot of the symptoms are the same, as Dr. Valenti points out. You know, and it's sometimes more difficult to sort of differentiate one from the other. I think if you're in a high risk group for influenza that you should get it, if you start getting symptoms, you need to go in and get tested mm-hmm. because there is medication, antivirals that you can take that will actually help make you feel better faster and reduce the risk of getting complications like a bacterial superinfection.
And who are those high-risk groups?
You're talking particularly infants under the age of 2 are highly susceptible and under the age of 5 in general. People 65 and older, people with chronic lung disease, history of asthma, heart disease, diabetes, if you're pregnant, if you live in a long-term care facility. Who have I missed?
Transplant patients, immunocompromised patients. And Dr. Bennett really is underscoring something that's so important. The most common question that I get is, when do I know to call the doctor? Most young, healthy people don't have the severity of illness. Mm. And one thing that I would add to what I always see with the cases of influenza I worry about are severe body aches, joint and muscle aches and pains. Mm. But it's hard sometimes to know whether to call the physician. So Dr. Bennett outlined the high-risk people. They should always be calling their doctor. Mm. Pregnant women should be calling their physician because we know that in pregnancy, particularly the last 2 trimesters, if you get influenza, it's very serious, which is why pregnant women should get vaccinated.
Absolutely.
and those who plan to get pregnant should be vaccinated.
Okay, but you know, the only people practically you didn't list are the middle-aged, healthy or seemingly healthy people, but they can also get very severe cases, correct?
Yes.
So,
yeah.
Again, it's the fever that would tip them off?
Again, it sort of depends on what you're,
and what the season is looking like. In the community, if there's a lot of flu, you know, a lot of doctors, when there's a tremendous amount of flu, we know it's in the community, they may even prescribe antivirals over the phone.
Uh-huh. Okay, you brought up antivirals. We'll talk about that a little bit later, but just how long does it take between getting exposed to the flu and coming down with it?
It can be anywhere from 1 to 3 days.
Okay.
I think that's right, Sarah.
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's spread by droplets or you've touched a surface that somebody has sneezed on and you've still got the virus there. Once you get vaccinated, the vaccine, it does take about 2 weeks to take effect to build up the antibodies that make it resistant. And but I should stress this, the vaccine does not give you the flu. Does not make you sick.
So I was going to ask you what the greatest misconception is people have. Is that it? That the vaccine will actually give you the flu?
Yes, that is a huge issue, and we are trying to disabuse people of that notion.
Are you having any luck? I mean, is that
why
the number of vaccinations has gone down? This anti-vax sort of movement?
Yes, that is part of it. Part of it is just a lot of misinformation out there. You know, I think Dr. Bennett mentioned early on, I believe she mentioned, or perhaps you did, that there was a tremendous drop, not a tremendous, but there was a drop in influenza vaccinations last season. There's this misconception, even among healthcare workers, that you can get the flu from the vaccine or that the vaccine is not protective. So one of the principles that we try to get across to folks is that the more people in the community that get vaccinated, the higher the number of people that will be protected. The higher the number of people in the community protected, the less opportunity to spread to those who are at risk. And so, you know, we acknowledge the vaccine may not be 100% effective, but again, getting that what we call herd immunity in place is what protects people.
Okay, so basically get the shots for yourself and for everybody else. We just need to take a quick break. We have a lot more to talk about. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Ocean View at Falmouth, committed to sustainability and dedicated to offering active retirement living with peace of mind for the future. And the Finance Authority of Maine, providing financial solutions that help Maine people achieve their business and higher educational goals. FameMaine.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Jonah Hill, co-star of Superbad, Moneyball, and The Wolf of Wall Street. He wrote and directed the new film Mid-90s about a group of skateboarders in the mid-90s. That's the period when Jonah Hill was skateboarding, but he was never great.
Because to be great at skateboarding, you have to be willing to slam on your face down 10 stairs on concrete over and over and over and
Join
over.
Join us.
Coming up tonight at 7 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Election Day is approaching, and Maine Public News has much of what you need to be informed about the candidates and the issues we'll be voting on in November. It's all at mainepublic.org/yourvote. You'll find analysis of the important issues, in-depth interviews and profiles of the candidates for governor, Senate, and our two congressional districts, our Maine Calling candidate programs, and our schedule of upcoming debates, which will also be available for on-demand listening as they become available. All this and more at mainepublic.org/yourvote, or click on Your Vote banner on the mainepublic.org homepage.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today on the program, what you need to know about the flu. Joining me in the studio, Dr. Siri Bennett. She's Maine State Epidemiologist. And Dr. August Valenti, he's Maine Medical Center's Hospital Epidemiologist. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And we were just talking about herd immunity and how getting the shot basically helps the whole community, not just yourself. But you also talked about how people think that getting the shot can give you the flu, and that is absolutely not true. However, you can get flu-like symptoms. Is that correct?
Yes. The flu vaccines do not contain influenza virus. They contain parts of the influenza virus. The one exception to that is the live attenuated, that means weakened, virus that we see in the nasal spray. But that is a weakened virus, and that is not recommended for people with weak immune systems. So the majority of the injectable vaccines, and not the majority, all of the injectable vaccines do not have influenza virus in it. The reason why people might think that they're getting the flu from the vaccine is because, A, they got the flu before they got vaccinated. B, they're in the period of time that the influenza, Dr. Bennett mentioned, it takes 2 weeks to build antibodies, and they may be in that period. C, they get a cold that they think is the flu. And maybe for them, you know, D is that the vaccine may not be all that effective. Dr. Bennett wanted to make a point before the break, and I think it's a very valuable point.
Go ahead.
Yeah, but just to carry on from what you were just saying, also the other thing is that there are many, many more influenza viruses out there that are not covered by the vaccine. The vaccine only covers the three or four most common.
That's right.
And so there are other viruses out there. So you may have come down with something related, and so maybe the vaccine is being partially protective, so it may not necessarily cover everything. The one thing I did want to mention that came to mind when we were talking a few minutes ago was that I know that there was a lot of criticism last year because people felt that the vaccine was not as effective as they would like. The research, when they went back and looked, even though the vaccine effectiveness may have been about 40%, it still saved hundreds of lives.
Okay.
And so even a partially effective vaccine saves lives. It's just enough to tip the scales so that you may just get a milder illness. You may not then develop the complications. You may not then pass it on to the infant in the household or the grandmother who's had a transplant. So even if it's not completely effective, it is still protective and keeps everybody healthier.
Okay. We have a question from a listener, somewhat related, email from Tricia. Among those in Maine who died or were hospitalized due to the flu, how many or what percentage had received a flu shot? What about the people around them? And did Mainers who had the flu last year fit the typical profile of people at higher risk of flu? That's a lot of questions, but the idea of those who were hospitalized or died, is there a way to know whether they got the flu shot or not?
We don't. We don't have that data, okay. Certainly not at the state level.
Not in Maine, but the federal CDC, we had about 80,000 deaths last year from influenza. They guesstimate, because they have to model some of this, because it is not notifiable, as Dr. Bennett said in the beginning. So we had about 900,000, I think, hospitalizations,
yes,
which is in excess of what we usually see, and then 80,000 deaths. We do know that the children that died, there weren't a lot of children who died in the last year's epidemic, but we do know that 85% of those youngsters were not vaccinated.
Oh, so
the youngsters that died. So the federal CDC does keep track of some of that information, we know we're missing an enormous number of cases.
So it's bound to be higher than that.
Yes, but those are good questions. We don't know the specifics for Maine.
Mm-hmm.
We definitely do know, though, that on the federal level, that the majority of people that that get the flu and that die are over the age of 65. That's the very, very vulnerable group. And aside from those who are immunocompromised, patients who are being treated for cancer, transplant patients, patients who have HIV disease, that population, influenza is much riskier in.
Okay. And the vaccine, you did say pregnant women can get it, yes. Babies can get it. Is there anyone
After six months.
Right.
Okay. Any other caveats to who can get the vaccine?
Well, the only thing is I do like to emphasize that the live attenuated vaccine, the nasal spray, while it is approved, I think it's for people over the age of 12.
Yeah, I forget which age you can start at. It's young adult going up to age 49, I think.
That's right.
But you can't give it to pregnant women either or mm-hmm. immunocompromised. The injectable vaccine is completely safe, and you can give that to anybody.
And most pediatricians still, we discontinued the live attenuated for a while. Most pediatricians that I know still favor the injectable.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We have a question from Bob calling from New Hampshire. Hi, Bob. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I'm a senior. There's two vaccines out there right now for seniors. I believe it's called Fluad and Fluzone. How would one choose between them? How do they differ from the regular vaccines? And the other question is, talk about flu season. Is there different flu seasons in the North Hemisphere and Southern Hemisphere?
Oh, great question.
And if there is, say what they had in New Zealand, give us a clue of what's coming our way.
Oh.
Very good
Thank
question,
you, Bob.
Okay. Well, interesting about flu seasons because you have two patterns of flu seasons. You've got the tropical countries where they get flu any time of year.
Oh.
Temperate climates, which you're talking North America, Australia, New Zealand, you know, on the other side of the equator, they get flu seasons primarily in their winters. And that's what we generally see. I was looking up the data the other day. Australia and New Zealand had a very mild season this last year. So hopefully, you know, we will follow suit.
Okay.
But
and then about the senior vaccines he was talking
so
about?
So there are, he is right. There is a high-dose vaccine, which now is, the CDC has not endorsed any particular vaccine for seniors. However, on their website, they fairly do indicate, I think it's fair to say, that there are now studies which suggest that the high-dose vaccine, which is a trivalent, that means it only has three of the viruses, two influenza A's and one B,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to the most vaccines, the quadrivalent, which has two B's and two A's. But that vaccine does have about four times the antigen, and it has been shown in studies to be more effective. The other vaccine is called Fluad, and that has an ingredient which is what we call an adjuvant. And that just makes the immune system work a little bit better. So those vaccines, I think, are either one would be fine for seniors. I think the one that's most often given is probably Fluzone here, but Fluad, it would be perfectly fine for seniors.
Okay, thanks for calling, Bob. And in terms of the vaccines that are offered at the grocery store, the drugstore, Target is offering them everywhere you go.
Soon to be Walmart.
Okay. Are those the same as the shots you would get at the doctor's office? Is there any reason to go one place or another?
No, we don't have any recommendation one over the other, really.
Okay. Mm-mm. All right. And we have, I'm trying to get this email from Lulu. While young and old people who are compromised by a weak immune system may be protected by a flu vaccination, I believe that a healthy immune system is ultimately strengthened by colds and flu. I feel like you are using fear to get people to vaccinate. I'd like to hear an opposing voice on this topic. We need to discuss good nutrition and how that helps us combat flu and other illnesses. Also, the vaccine doesn't seem to make that much of a difference in the number of people getting the flu.
Well, let me just open by saying that's an unfortunate position, okay? Again, let's go back to the concept of herd immunity. Vaccines have definitely impacted, all vaccines have definitely favorably impacted the health of the world. We've actually eliminated diseases in the world, and we've substantially reduced infant mortality and the complications that come from, or childhood mortality, I should say, and the complications that come from these diseases. Influenza is absolutely no exception. And I think to expose youngsters to potentially serious illnesses, as Dr. Bennett mentioned, youngsters under the age of 5 and particularly under the age of 2 can die from influenza. And we know, our data shows, that vaccination is the best protection against influenza. Now, the point made by the caller about middle-aged people who may not be so immunocompromised, for many years, doctors did not emphasize the immunization of people in the healthier age groups. But we now think that's wrong, largely because of the number of folks who are so vulnerable, and again, that concept of getting as many people immunized as possible. I will also, though, I want to agree with the caller about good nutrition and healthy habits. That for sure needs to be emphasized. And quite frankly, Dr. Bennett and I will tell you, maybe more than once during this program, that using good hand hygiene, using good respiratory etiquette, which is coughing and sneezing into your sleeve and not reusing tissues and storing them in your pocket and washing your hands and being careful about touching surfaces and then your face, these are all sensible, non-vaccinated, non-vaccine-related things that one can do. So I sort of agree with your caller, but I think it's not smart to discourage vaccination.
Yeah, and I would agree with Dr. Valenti. You know, while of someone in their middle years and who's very healthy and has a strong immune system may be able to withhold and, you know, and recover from infection, it's the people around that person, the young people, the children, the elderly who are susceptible that are at risk. And so what I tell people is, don't do it for yourself. Do it for your family, for the people around you who could get sick if you have the flu. The other thing, too, is that, you know, as we've talked about, the virus shifts the makeup. And every year it's slightly different. So the antibodies that you may have one year may not necessarily protect you the next year. So, you know, it's this sort of ongoing battle. Yes, and as Dr. Valenti says, you know, the no flu for you guidelines. Wash your hands frequently. Cover your cough. Stay home if you're sick. And get vaccinated.
Okay.
Those are the key messages.
And the good nutrition is just icing on the cake.
Absolutely. You'll recover better if you have good nutrition. Absolutely.
But in terms of certain foods being, you know, kind of countering the flu.
Chicken soup.
Okay. The good old-fashioned ones. Okay. And you talked a little bit about antivirals earlier. There's a new antiviral medication the FDA just approved. I don't know how to pronounce the name of it, but they're saying it's better than what's been available. How much do these help?
Yeah, the standard is what most people will refer to as Tamiflu, which is oseltamivir. There's another antiviral called zanamivir. These are the two that have been mostly available. There is another one that we used mostly in the hospital, which is peramivir. Just recently, last week actually, the FDA approved a new novel type of antiviral called baloxavir marboxil, which is going to go under the fancy name of Zofluza.
That's the one I was afraid to try.
Good for you.
Good naming.
I think it's Zofluza. Yeah.
Yes.
The advantage to this, it's probably not inferior to Tamiflu. The advantage to this is that it's a one-dose drug, whereas with Tamiflu, you have to take it twice a day for 5 days. But this drug is just once. And so that's an advantage because we know that we can get better compliance.
It shortens the course, that's all. Nothing's going to get rid of the flu, but they alleviate it.
It shortens the course. And as you mentioned, I think it can mitigate the symptoms so that it's not as severe. And I'll tell you, if you've ever had real influenza, even a day's grace is very welcome.
Oh, yes. We have an email from Robin. She asks, is using a nasal saline flush twice a day effective at preventing viruses? If so, What about the xylitol nasal spray? And there's information from the xylitol.org site that says, since xylitol reduces the germs, pollutants, and irritants from sticking to the tissue, regular use of xylitol nasal spray results in fewer respiratory infections and easier breathing. Have you heard of this?
Well, yes. I don't know whether they put the caveat about whether the FDA approves of these uses. But on the other hand, let me just say that keeping your mucous membranes moist with saline flushes may be beneficial. And actually, there have been other preparations which coat the portion of the nostrils with something that allows pollen and things like that and even bacteria perhaps to stick there and not go down. I do think there's a benefit to keeping mucous membranes healthy and moist and not cracking and dry, which would open you up to more bacteria and viral types of problems. So there's probably some benefit to it.
Okay. We're talking about the flu, but we're going to take another quick break. And first, a word about tomorrow's show. Join host Keith Shortall and our panel of editorial page editors to discuss the top news of the month in Maine. Email your questions and comments to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. Or you can leave a voicemail before the show at 207-370-3487. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do UMaine's Collin Center, with The Nature of Forgetting, a life-affirming theatrical journey. October 30th, collinscenterforthearts.com, an evergreen home performance dedicated to helping homeowners qualify for Efficiency Maine energy audit and insulation rebates. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And coming up shortly at 2 o'clock after Maine Calling, it's World Affairs. Nicholas Burns, former U.S. ambassador and professor at Harvard Kennedy School, discusses the role of U.S. leadership and how traditional American diplomacy can help ease today's global tensions. Again, that's coming up at 2 o'clock after Maine Calling. All this week, Maine Public Radio and Television are broadcasting our Your Vote 2018 debates. Wednesday evening at 8 o'clock is the first broadcast of our Senate debate on Maine Public Television. Here on radio at 2 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon, it's a rebroadcast of our gubernatorial debate. As the election approaches, a reminder you'll find the on-air debate schedule, analysis of the important issues, in-depth interviews, and profiles of the candidates, our Maine Calling candidate interviews, and more at mainepublic.org/yourvote, or click on the Your Vote banner on the mainepublic.org homepage.
Welcome back. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Fighting the Flu. Joining us today, August Valenti, he's epidemiologist with Maine Med, and Siri Bennett, epidemiologist for the state of Maine. Join our conversation. Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-399-3566, and we will now go to a call from Penny calling from Exeter. Hi, Penny. What's your question?
Hi there. I have a couple of questions or concerns. First of all, this is aside from the flu, but I'm the generation where our mothers exposed us all to the mumps and chickenpox and measles. And with the medical world's approval and suggestion, and we never knew anybody who died. I mean, that's amazing. We had parties, you know. But anyway, one of my two concerns is, first of all, the interaction that I believe there can't be long-term studies about the interaction of all these new vaccines that are coming down the pipeline. Can't even be short-term studies, really, about how these things, I mean, now children from day one on through adolescence are, the protocol is 72 doses of vaccinations, some, you know, repeat. The other thing is, I know that trimerosal does, now we know, cross the blood-brain barrier. And I'm wondering if I think I understood, but I'm not sure about this, so I'm interested in what you experts have to say, whether the multi-dose flu shots have trimerosal as, I think, an adjuvant. I'm not sure. But maybe the single shots don't. So
okay.
Thimerosal is a preservative.
On that.
No.
Yes,
those are great questions, Penny.
Mercury, yes.
So as far as her concerns about vaccines, the number of them and the content of them.
Yes, actually, there are studies that go through the safety of giving more than one vaccine at once. There are experts in the field that are also looking at these kinds of issues, but we do give more than one vaccine. There are sometimes interactions. You have to be careful about the timing of certain vaccinations, particularly measles, Dr. Bennett.
Right, and those that are live vaccine versus, you know.
That's right.
So there's issues around some of that. Yeah. But they've tried, they've worked out, they're very careful about what kind of schedule you have and what can go with what.
Penny should know that there are people who share those concerns in our field. And it has been looked at, and really, we don't have a lot of evidence that there are problems.
Okay, thanks for your call, Penny. We have an email question from James. What is the major difference between vaccination and inoculation, and does it affect the influenza virus? Definition there. Is there a difference? Is that the same word?
That's a very...
I'd have to look it up.
These are technical infectious diseases terms. Inoculum really means the amount of a particular bacterium, virus, or fungus that is put into an organ or into the skin. So inoculation simply means that you're taking an amount, a dose, and you're putting it in this case, into the muscles for influenza. There was an intradermal, but I don't think we don't have any intradermals now, but So that technically is what inoculum means. So inoculation grew out of that. It's the same as vaccination, bottom line.
Okay, we won't complicate things more. We'll shift to an email from Dre. My questions, number one, regarding these adaptogenic shifts mentioned, does the flu ever shift back to old strains of the past, or is the shift always new and mutating? A couple more questions here. Oh, approximately how many strains are there? And number two, any flu strain I've caught and struggled through in the past, am I now immune to that particular strain? Thank you.
Wow, this is a very informed
audience.
It's a test
question, yeah.
Yeah, this is, do you want to handle that? I think the H1N1, I believe, was very similar to the 1918 Spanish influenza.
Yeah.
So there may be a sort of, what he's asking is there ever a reversion to what we used to call the wild type, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's possible if we haven't seen a strain in a while. But more often than not, immunity, as Dr. Bennett underscored, really changes because of these little drifts, if you will, in the coating of the virus. And again, that is why we haven't really come up with a one dose or two dose flu vaccine, because we're most of the antigens that we're directed against are against the surface of the virus. I don't know whether I answered all of those excellent questions.
Well, so for her question about anything she's caught in the past, would she be immune? It sounds like they're never really the same.
Well, there's partial immunity.
Yeah. Okay.
So that we know that older patients are partially immune, you know, may not have done as poorly with the H1N1. But I think that it's safe to assume that you're better off getting vaccinated and not taking the chance.
Okay.
Yep.
What is the worst case scenario for the flu? I mean, I guess you can die from it, but how does that progression usually occur?
So the worst case scenario is you get a severe case of influenza pneumonia. Influenza pneumonia is difficult to treat. It is treatable. That is a pneumonia actually caused by the virus. And then again, the other worst case scenario, as I mentioned previously, is the invasion of the lower respiratory tract by bacteria already weakened by the flu. So you may have somebody that has had influenza, they're getting better, and then all of a sudden they get sick again. And that could mean that they've got a bacterial infection, such as the pneumococcus, which is where pneumonia gets its origin. I guess actually the pneumococcus got its name from pneumonia.
Which came first.
Yeah. And then staphylococcus. These are the ones that invade the lower respiratory tract and cause disease. And a lot of these patients end up in the special care unit with all kinds of complications, renal kidney failure and heart conditions, heart problems, et cetera. So That's the worst case scenario, I think.
Right. Yeah, and if you've got underlying medical conditions that make you more susceptible and you're less able to fight off the infection, you're more likely to get that bacterial infection or to have trouble kicking that influenza pneumonia. And you can just go downhill, and as you said, it can kill you.
And the flip side, the best case scenario is it just feels like a bad cold and you stay at home and it goes away in how long?
So some people will get over it within a few days. I have to say, that's not
that's
been
quick.
My experience.
Yeah, no, mine's about a week. Yeah.
Right. And many people, it'll be 2 to 3 weeks untreated with influenza. So I think that, again, it varies depending upon your immune status or what have you. But max, I would think, is 3 weeks.
Okay. We have an email from Jamie. I had Guillain-Barré years ago.
Excellent.
Did I say that right? I was advised not to get the flu shot. Do you agree?
You should. You want to answer that, Siri, because I know the answer to it. If you got Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a neurological disorder, ascending paralysis, it's called. It's a serious neurological disorder. Fortunately, it is treatable. If you had Guillain-Barré within 6 weeks of an influenza shot, we are advising people not to get influenza vaccine. Outside of that 6 weeks period, we don't think it's related. And it's really difficult. The data to suggest a correlation between Guillain-Barré and influenza, I think it's not, it may not be all that strong. I think Dr. Bennett may have more to say about that. But we know there was an increase in background Guillain-Barré. There was an increase from the background of Guillain-Barré during the H1N1 problem that we had, and that's why a lot of people were very nervous that the influenza vaccine may contribute to it. But that's an excellent question. So if you got it within 6 weeks of a vaccination, you probably shouldn't get vaccinated, but I would still talk to your doctor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think Guillain-Barré, isn't that can also be associated with other kinds of vaccinations?
Yes,
it's not just influenza.
Oh. Yes.
So it's one of those conditions that we still don't really understand where it comes from and why it shows up in some people. Fortunately, it's very rare.
Yes.
But it's not just influenza vaccine that it's...
Okay. Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay. We have another question in email from Marion. What about timing for the flu shot? Is the vaccine most effective in the first weeks following the shot as the immune system ramps up? I was waiting till just before an upcoming trip.
It takes 2 weeks for the vaccine to take effect. We know that because it takes 2 weeks for the antibodies to get up and running. Our recommendation is get it at the start of flu season. It's going to hang around long enough so that it should cover you throughout the flu season. Having said that, if you haven't gotten it yet, it's still not too late, and you can get it at any time during the flu season.
How late?
Anytime.
Anytime.
Okay.
And
sometimes there are community outbreaks, and we want people to get vaccinated.
Yeah, and there may be an outbreak, community outbreak in March, and that's still not too late to get it. But you're more protected if you get it sooner because it means that you're going to be more protected.
And when is peak season?
Oh,
that
we
depends
don't know.
Too?
It depends.
I'm asking
again,
you to look in your crystal ball.
Between December and, I guess, February.
February or March.
On average. Oh,
yeah.
So even into March.
Yeah, it can.
Oh, yeah.
You know, each year is slightly different.
Okay.
Yeah, we saw
but
cases
prime time
into May.
Is now to get the shot. Prime time would be right
yes,
now.
Yes, absolutely.
I need to do. I'm listening to you and thinking I have to go get my shot.
Before the end of October.
Okay, well, that's tomorrow. Great. Okay. We will go to Seth in Augusta. Hi, Seth. You're on Maine Calling.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I had a couple questions that I suppose took a little more towards comments, but I wanted to hear your commentator's thoughts about these. I'm actually a practicing emergency doctor in Brunswick right now, and I trained in Pittsburgh and have the background of, having grandparents who remember getting the polio vaccine, a disease that we eradicated. And I wanted to emphasize, I heard an earlier caller mentioning that, healthy people, their immune systems can fight this off. And my experience has actually been that's not always the case. I was a brand new doctor when H1N1 came out.
That's right.
I saw a lot of people my own age who were in their early 30s and on ventilators, several of whom died in the couple weeks I was rotating through an ICU. because there's actually your immune system can overreact. And that was the same thing with the 1918 pandemic, which killed more people than World War One. I don't think, you know, being needlessly scared is a good objective, but I think there's a fair bit to be concerned about here. And I think that applies whether you're generally healthy or not. And I'd just love to hear your thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you, Seth.
Thank you so much for that, because that is you really made a very, very important point. The overactive immune system of some young, healthy folks can definitely significantly worsen a disease. And I think that I wish that I had remembered to make that point. That is really good. Thank you for that.
Yes. And I think that, you know, younger adults, let's face it, when we're that age, we feel like we're invincible. And we really aren't. We don't know how our bodies are going to respond. And there are things out there that we just, our bodies cannot handle.
Okay. And we have an email from Natalie. This is a bit of a long one, but I'll read this. My son, who just turned 18, has cystic fibrosis, as well as being liver transplant patient. He also underwent treatment for lymphoma when he was 12. He has always gone to public schools where they offer flu shots every year. Our entire family has mandatory flu shots every year for the last 18 years with no ill effects. 1 year out of 18, we all did come down with the flu, but most likely a milder case. My son, however, always ends up in the hospital for at least 2 weeks if he does get the flu or any lung-based virus or bacterial illness, which can be life-threatening. I urge all parents to vaccinate their children and themselves for flu, especially if they go to public schools. While your child may be healthy and can recover, not all children are so lucky. Please, please look out for our whole community. So again, the herd mentality, the herd community.
Absolutely.
What is it? Herd immunity. There we go.
Right.
Herd mentality. I made up
a new term.
I think that's great. Thank you for pointing that out.
She makes a really good point. Pertussis, you asked about pertussis earlier on. A lot of times we are seeing children going into school not immunized against pertussis, and then adults get it and other youngsters get it. So that's a really good point she's made, and I appreciate it.
And public schools, also restaurants. We've gotten some messages, which I'm afraid we don't have time to go into, but asking about the risk of spreading the flu when servers and cooks in the restaurants are themselves sick.
Well, there is some risk if they touch surfaces. The return to work, Dr. Bennett and I were talking about this earlier, the return to work is always, especially in healthcare institutions, it's a big deal because it depends upon the kind of patients you're going to be taking care of. If you're going to be taking care of patients who are immunocompromised, we ask our healthcare workers to stay out a little bit longer. But most people can return to work about 24 to 48 hours after their last fever without taking Tylenol or acetaminophen or aspirin. They can return to work, but they have to practice superb hand hygiene.
Okay. Superb hand hygiene. That's the last word for today. Thank you both for joining us. Dr. Siri Bennett, Maine State Epidemiologist, and Dr. August Valenti, Hospital Epidemiologist for Maine Medical Center. Sandra Harris ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling at mainecalling.org. Today's show will be broadcast again tonight at 9. A reminder that we have our Your Vote candidate interviews at mainepublic.org. I'm Cindy Hahn. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.